sorry, sir. Slaves. I'm sorry. Black persons. I'm sorry. Oh, Lord.
He licked his lips. Snot ran from his nose. When Matty Newell told this story later, he'd say I had a shotgun at least. Machine gun, maybe. Martha with a pistol in each hand, the both of us dripping with knives. Slaves go there? It's not unusual?
It's not.
Okay. Okay. I had what I needed. Almost. The music had kicked up again, tightening my chest. There was a sickening feeling of excitement getting going in me as I realized what was going to happen. What I was going to have to do. The man was here. William Smith. He was here. I pulled open the top drawer of Newell's desk and started to rifle through it, thinking quickly, okay.
What?
Said Mr. Newell.
What are you doing?
Stay there, man. Stay. He stayed down on his knees, his hands behind his head. Mr. Newell looked to Martha, but she did not even see. She was at the desk now. She had found the page I had been looking at. She was staring at the screen. Oh, Martha. I took the scissors out of Newell's desk, and his eyes bulged.
No,
he said, his voice rising. Waddling backwards on his haunches, hands behind his head, repeating his refrain.
I never did any harm to any Negro person.
Quiet, please. I was unbuttoning my shirt. I was stepping out of my shoes. I held the scissors in my right hand and pointed at Newell with them. How do I get to Free White Housing Area 9? He told me what I needed to know. While he was talking, I turned the scissors to my neck and began to carve, bringing up a deep well of blood, hacking away. Right where I had my inked-in tattoo. Right at the root of my neck. I needed blood. I needed a fresh wound. You had to be very sick, puking and shitting sick, to be brought to a doctor's attention around here. That I knew. A bad cut, though, was not the end of the world. Steroid shot and a bandage, you're on your way. Martha, I said. There's a first aid kit on the bottom shelf over there. Can you get me some gauze, please? She was still at the computer, transfixed by the screen. Martha was not watching us anymore. Her attention was wholly on that computer screen where Samson's face and fate were still displayed. She had taken a step forward. She had reached her hand halfway up toward the screen, a small gesture full of grief. I got the bandage myself, worked it slowly around and around my neck. When I was wound up, three thick layers of gauze covering my fresh, credible wound, covering where I would have borne the sheltering G of GGSI, when I had what I needed for Mr. Newell to get across campus, I pulled the cords from the printer and from the computer one by one. Martha kept looking at the screen, even as it went blank. I had a couple more questions for Mr. Newell, but when I had all of them answered, I pushed him all the way to the ground.
I never, he said, sobbing. Never.
I know, I said. You never did any harm to any Negro person. But I'm going to tie you up now. Bind your hands and feet. Bind your mouth to keep you quiet. And put you in the closet. I got to it. I did it fast. When he was in there, far from his panic button, far from his phone, I gently guided Martha away from the desk. I took her by the hands, got her to look at my eyes. Here's what's happening. You take the elevator down. You walk briskly across the lobby and say thank you to that blonde girl and get in your car and drive north.
Yeah,
she said.
Okay.
Are you listening? Her eyes were not on the screen anymore, but that's where she was. She was with him. She was with her Samson, far away. I squeezed her hands between mine, squeezed each individual finger, trying to gather her attention, get her here, with me. You go and get Lionel from your sister's house and get that money I gave you and drive to Canada or fly overseas. Go anywhere. Go somewhere good. You got it?
I do.
That's enough bread to start a new life, and that's what I want you to do, okay? Get that boy out of America. Get him out.
You...
She looked at me, shirtless, shoeless, wrapped with gauze, the simple black slacks now looking dingy, pathetic, slave garb.
What are you doing?
I gotta finish this up.
And then how are you going to get out?
I'll figure it out. Her eyes at last were back in focus. She was back in the room.
How? How are you going to figure it out?
Chapter 7. Poor Mr. Newell, inarticulate with fear though he was, had managed to answer my questions one by one. Even the question I hadn't known to ask. What is the line around the property? The broken black line that had puzzled me when I first got a look at the full file. It was a train. A subway. Not an electric fence or utility pipe, but an underground train. Delivering persons bound to labor from the population center to their shifts. It explained why I'd seen no actual people at work from way up there in the perch where Newell had taken us so he could crow. The slaves were out in the far-flung acreage of the cotton fields. The slaves were laboring in the high floors of the stitch houses. The slaves were transported below ground where they couldn't be seen. Not past the headquarters buildings full of happy Maddie Newells meeting in conference rooms and making calls, doing no harm to any Negro person. "You'll take the service elevator," Newell had said. "The door will open directly onto the platform." So down I went, shirtless and shoeless, disguised in my 5 feet of bandage and bright green wristband and my own black skin. I rode the service elevator down from Newell's 14th floor office with my head slightly lowered, my brain on fire. As it descended, I began to hear music, loud and martial music. And when the elevator door opened, I was in a gigantic room full of men singing. The men were shirtless and shoeless, as I was, and they were facing away from me, just backs and heads, rows and rows of backs and heads, hundreds of men standing totally still, their voices raised. "These strong hands belong to you," they sang in chorus. "Hands and back and spirit too." The melody was simple, a childish four-note sing-song, "Every day and all I do." I shouldered my way forward, finding a spot in the crowd. "GGSI, my heart is true." Now I was in among them, and nobody looked at me, nobody said, "Who the fuck are you?" I was one more shirtless man with a wristband and black pants, with mummy strips of bandage covering my neck and shoulder. "As thou hast done in days gone by," I listened to the lyrics. I got it by heart. "Oh Lord, protect GGSI." That was it. After that, the song just started again, and now I sang it too. "These strong hands belong to you." I found a place between two men. The first was about my age, maybe a little younger, with high cheekbones and small eyes. The other was middle-aged, with a wide forehead and bulb nose, and beside him was a man with a striking face, a square, dimpled chin and high cheekbones. And then there was another, and another. All the kinds of faces in all the colors the world calls black. Brown and tan and yellow and orange, copper and bronze and gold. "These strong hands belong to you." They sang, we sang, with no enthusiasm or joy. We used to sing at bells, crossing the yard or working on the pile, just like slaves used to sing in old slavery. Spirituals and work songs, sly lyrics, silly lyrics, yearning for freedom or roasting Massa in nonsense words he couldn't understand. This, though, this was a different kind of singing. I looked from man to man and they were singing mechanically, eyes front, mouths moving like puppets, singing this dumb refrain about how much they loved their bosses and loved their work. Nothing spiritual about this. This was something else altogether. There were no women. The women were somewhere else. Where were the women? Things were coming loose in me, being down here with all these men. Things were coming loose. I felt like I might fall down, but I could not do that. None of these men was wavering. They stood completely still, staring straight ahead, only singing. What I did was, I focused on the room, focused on noticing things. I was in a subway station, a platform, a kind of place familiar to me from New York, from Washington, D.C., from 100 different hunts. A cavernous room lit dimly by overhead fixtures hanging from a high-domed roof. A concrete floor ending like a cliff edge above the sunken well of the tracks. I focused on the room and the sound of my own voice singing along. "These strong hands." I kept it in. I kept it all in. I had to keep it in, so I kept it in, made my face like their faces, expressionless, only the mouth moving. But I was too close to their faces. For my whole career under bridge, I had always dreaded the page of the file that showed the photograph, the real human face of the man I was seeking, and now here I was among them. None of this plebe shit, none of this persons bound, no slaves down here. All that abstraction torn away like skin coming off a body, and these were people. Human fucking beings. Each with the one life he was given, and this was the life they had. The music stopped in the middle of a line, and back, and spirit, and we stopped singing. "Arms out!" The voice came through from on high, burred and flattened by the intercom. "Hands up!" Everybody did as instructed. Extended their arms, raised their hands. I did it too. This was it. My rushing emotion was subsumed in a sudden heat of panic. Newell had untied himself somehow, stumbled, screaming, into the carpeted hallway, where it was Martha. They'd stopped her in the lobby. They'd stopped her in the car. She was in no shape. Heads back! We tilted back our heads, stared at the ceiling. The men around me followed the instructions dully, robotically. This seemed to be an everyday occurrence. This was protocol. On my left hand was the green wristband the guard had fitted me for. In my right hand was a piece of paper that Newell had filled out and stamped under my command. Temporary intercampus travel certificate. Permission slip. Travel papers. Some of the men around me, I noticed, carried similar passes. Others had none. Some wore, along with the green band, other bands of different colors in various places up and down their arms. A whole world of systems, of rules and regulations. The intercom voice again. Hold pose! A frozen moment. A room cramped with shirtless men, all of us with heads tilted back, arms up and out. People like trees. 45 and under, hands down! Most of the men lowered their arms to their sides. I did too. The older men kept their arms up. There was a man moving through the platform. The slaves parted to let him through. He was black, as we were, but wearing a shirt and boots. He came within a few feet of me, but did not look in my direction, did not see me, the infiltrator, where I stood with my eyes lowered like everybody else. The train was coming. I felt the familiar stale breeze being pushed forward along the tunnel, but nobody moved. This guard, or trustee, whatever he was, moved from man to man, all those with their hands still up, checking for something in their mouths. Push his index finger between their lips, force open their teeth, then worm his finger around, upper palate, lower palate, then out. His face was set, mean, like Harbor, the hard boy who'd haunted my childhood at Bell's. Thinking of Harbor, I thought of Castle, and I felt a dizzy sense of the world collapsing, of my lifetimes flattening together into one plane. And meanwhile, his overseer type appeared to have found who he was looking for among the 45-plus men. He took his finger from the man's mouth, had him bend over, and began to pat down the length of his body. The train pulled into the station, and its doors pulsed open. Nobody moved. Up, said the overseer or trustee to the man. Let's go. The 45-plus nodded and lowered his hands and allowed himself to be led through the crowd toward the exit at the end of the platform. And his face remained as impassive as all the other faces. But his eyes? I saw it. A flickering in his eyes. I saw it. A slight widening. Absolute and abject terror. I had read about the up-to-date disincentive programs that were run in plantations now. All that shit that had come online since my days at Bell's. They were permitted now to tie you to a plank, pour water in your mouth to simulate drowning. They were permitted now to employ electric shocks. The science was in place to precisely measure out the voltage. All the uses of darkness, of noise, everything was carefully regulated, of course, BLP officials on hand at all times. That man, that 45-plus, they took him away. At no clear signal, we all got on the train. It was 24 men to a train car, 12 on either side. There were no seats. We stood, staring straight ahead. The train pulled away from the station and we all began to sing again. Endless choruses of the same song, no variation. There were no windows on the train. The man across from me was barrel-chested with a thick bull neck and deep-set eyes. The train was loud in the tunnel, rushing and roaring through the darkness. It was hard to think with the singing and the rattle of the train. The train ran in a simple circle around the plantation, 14 stops in all. But I just had to make it through 4 of them. Headquarters to facilities maintenance, facilities maintenance to Stitch House 1, Stitch House 1 to Stitch House 2, Stitch House 2 to Free White Housing. I looked past the big barrel-chested man. Behind him in small letters where one metal plate of the car structure met the next were the words, Stipley Fabricating Service, Louisville, Kentucky. Just beneath the word Kentucky, one tiny machine screw was coming loose. I saw its head, a flat, silver insect, poking like a secret from the surface of the train wall. I watched the screw as we juddered along. At the first stop, facilities maintenance, a middle-aged white woman got on in the bright orange jumpsuit of the Bureau of Labor Practices. The singing stopped, but the train began to roll again, and she made her way down the center aisle, counting heads, clicking a small handheld clicker, one click for each of us. She did this while whistling slightly to herself distractedly, the way you might move through a crowd of chickens in a pen. Nobody looked at her. Nobody looked at anybody else. We just kept singing. I stared at the tiny loose metal screw.
All right, folks,
she said brightly.
Thanks very much.
And she moved through to the next car. At Stitch House 1, 9 slaves got off and 9 new slaves took their places. I did not look at the new faces. I was going to find William Smith and I was going to ask him my questions. Find out where the package was, get the fuck out of there. How are you going to figure it out? And go and get it. I should have felt something. I should have been excited. I should have been reveling in a moment, an opportunity that had at long last arrived. But there on the train car, surrounded by men who would ride this train forever, I did not feel shit. I just wanted to get this done, get it over with and get out. Between the 3rd and 4th stations, the train stopped again. Hands in, said an intercom voice, and before I could wonder what that meant, a pair of shackles dropped and dangled in front of me and in front of everybody else on the train car. 1 pair per passenger. They appeared and hung there like oxygen masks coming down when a plane has lost cabin pressure. I followed the others, did what they did, raised my hands and stuck them through the holes. The manacles tightened automatically, biting into my wrists. I still had my pass, my temporary intracampus travel certificate. It was tight between my forefinger and thumb. The doors opened at either end and 2 men came in, 1 at each end, black men, like the one from the platform who'd led off the 45+. Petty authorities, whatever they called them here. One of them had a dog. They wore uniforms, the same color scheme as the one worn by the guard who'd gone over me in the lobby, the same as the carpeting in Newell's office, cotton white and blue sky blue. All right, y'all, said the first from the forward end of the car. Who's feeling good today? The man talking was the taller of the pair, with a broad chest and dark, shining eyes. His voice had a rousing, rolling cadence. Who's feeling good? Everybody answered together. I am good. Who's feeling strong? This time I was ready. I joined in. I am. He nodded again, beaming. Now y'all know this. GGSI loves you. Every man on that car spoke it in unison. Thank you, GGSI. Now GGSI is here to take care of you. Thank you, GGSI. The other overseer down at the back end was nodding heartily at everything, mouthing the answers too. He stood there holding the dog's leash. His attentive expression matched the dog's. Let me ask y'all something. The overseer who was running the show here, he licked his lips. He bounced on the balls of his feet. The dog poked its nose around. I was scared of that dog. Who is it that gives us these clothes? GGSI. Who puts food in our bellies? GGSI. That's right. Sing it, brothers. Sing it with me now. And we were back into it. Hands and backs and spirit too. Everybody singing with noticeably more verve now in the presence of the law. While we sang, the 2 overseers worked their way down the line, 1 on either side, checking everybody's papers. This was not perfunctory either. They were holding pens, checking carefully while the singing went on around them. You good? Looking each man in the eye, then looking at the paperwork, nodding. You good? You good? My pass was incomplete. As the trustee on my side drew closer, he and his dog, I managed a good clear look at the temporary intracampus travel certificate of the man beside me, and I could see how Newell had fucked me. At the bottom, not in any box, just jammed in where there was space for it next to the signature, this man's pass bore an inky thumbprint. By accident or by design, Newell had left mine off. I kept singing. I considered my options. My hands were shackled. The snare was sprung, the lock in place. I had no options. I continued to sing. I watched the overseer moving down the line, watched my madman's game sailing towards its end. I should have felt scared, I knew. I should have felt the horror of the man trapped in his fate. Instead, I was just thinking, I failed you. A quick burst of felt thought like a prayer. But I wasn't sure who I was praying to. Whom had I failed? The overseer was in front of me now, running his eyes over my face. He took the piece of paper from between my fingers and looked at it closely. His expression did not harden. His round cheeks did not change. As thou hast done in times gone by, I sang, O Lord, protect GGSI. The man turned very slightly back toward the other overseer to check where he was. Then he took my pass, and when he placed it back in my hand, it had a thumbprint on the bottom. You good, he said, and kept moving. When the men were done, The shackles loosened just enough for us to withdraw our hands, but they stayed dangling, jostling and swinging in front of our eyes as the train lurched back into motion. The next stop was Free White Housing, and I got off. That is one of the moments I still think about. Lord, I do. I've tried to enact it. The small, quick, dangerous motions. To pop his thumb quickly in and out of his mouth, drag it through Newell's signature, jam the smeary thumb pad into the corner of my paper. Furtive movements. 1, 2, 3. I think about that moment all the time. How nice it would have been to say thank you. To say something. This man, a stranger to me. My hero. I would have kissed him. I returned in my mind to Bell's, to Chicago, to the thousand small kindnesses with which we armored ourselves against the world. Free White Housing Area 9 was visible from where the train doors opened, an ugly apartment block surrounded by a high chain-link fence. I booked it over there, hustling quick, eyes front, knees up. I ran past a high guard tower, ran with my back erect and my paper held out in front of me, thinking, one way or another, this is almost over. The fence was unlocked. As I was going in, a pair of whites was coming out, rumpled blue work clothes marked GGSI, and I stepped aside, angled my eyes down. They took no notice. The buildings of Free White Housing were pale sandstone apartment houses, the kind of undistinguished clustered residences you see on the outskirts of poor towns. Every apartment with a tiny balcony facing squarely forward, overlooking a concrete courtyard below. 4 balconies per floor, 6 floors up. Apartments like cages, like drawers in a roll-top desk, identical and interchangeable, like pigeonholes in a wall. I found Building B and pressed the button for Apartment 8. I had to stand calmly. I had to force my body to be still. Pressed the button again and waited. They found him out, I was thinking. William Smith. He made a run for it. He's dead. But then when I pressed the button again, there were footsteps thumping 1,000 miles an hour coming down from the steps inside. "Stop buzzing," said a voice, muffled through the door. "Stop buzzing." The door of the lobby jerked open. A rag doll of a man with a thin neck and long, greasy, heavy metal hair jutted his head outside into the courtyard, looked around quickly. "Get in, man. Get in, for fuck's sake, get in." Chapter 8. Billy Smith was in a bad, bad way. "Oh, man, oh, man, oh, man," he kept saying, a steady mumble, all the time shaking his head, gritting his teeth, running one hand through his greasy, heavy metal hair. "Oh, man, oh, man, oh, man." "Why don't we have a seat, Mr. Smith?" I said. I kept saying. But he couldn't do it or wouldn't. He told me to call him Billy. Everybody fucking called him Billy. But that was all the sense I got out of him, at least at first. I sat watching him from one of his 2 folding chairs while he smoked and paced the tiny apartment in caged tiger loops, trailing ash, stepping over and around styrofoam food cartons and empty beer bottles. Billy didn't look like any truck driver I had ever seen. Lean and lank with nervous, edgy eyes that flickered constantly into all corners of the room. "You just gotta tell him I'm fucking sorry, man," he said over and over and over in our first few minutes together, no matter what I asked, no matter where I tried to start. "You just gotta tell him I'm fucking sorry, okay?" "Sure," I said. "You bet, but listen, Billy,
you'll tell him, please."
I couldn't make him slow down. I couldn't make him hear me. Billy was operating on some level beyond my reach. The air in the apartment was a low, thick funk, the smell of a scared little man, an addict who had run out of whatever it was that kept him bumping along life's bottoms.
"I did what I could, okay? I'm sorry. Things don't always... I did my best, okay?"
He lit a new cigarette with the end of the one he was smoking and shook his head bitterly.
"I don't know why I ever got involved with all this mess. I really, surely do not."
Inhaling, twitching, pulsing.
"It all just depends who's on the gate, you know? And it was supposed to be Murph, but it wasn't Murph, and there's nothing I could do, so I'm sorry. Will you tell them, will you?"
"Mr. Smith?" I said, real loud. Then I slapped my hand down hard on the table, and for whatever reason, that caught him. He stopped moving. Rubbed his 4 fingers into his eyes, shook his head, then took a good look at me at last. No shirt, black pants, green wristband.
"What center you sneak out of?"
"I'm not part of the population here, Billy. I'm from the outside."
"No shit."
His eyes went wide.
"How'd you get in?"
"That doesn't matter."
"Jesus. Jesus fucking Christ."
He rushed over to the window, slowly lifted one slat of the blinds, and peeked outside, clutching his chest.
"Jesus.
And he was off. A new tense orbit around the apartment. This man had all sorts of cosmic things going on in his mind, some stew of fear and regret and, unless I missed my guess, early stage narcotics withdrawal.
They're coming, he said now. They're fucking coming.
Who, Billy?
Bosses, man.
He gaped at me.
Boss is always coming, man. It's not my house, you know what I'm saying? They can come in anytime they want to. They got that right, okay? It's my house, you know, but they own it. Rent comes right out of my check. Everything, food, water, stove, gas, everything.
He had ramped up. He was talking fast, a million nervous miles an hour.
They can come in whenever. My man Jackie Boy in Building C, he got jacked for porn. Black girl porn, too, which they fucking hate. Tossed him right the fuck out. I knew a guy. Bolo, Bowler, Bowser, something, in FW6. He had a bunch of coke in a baggie in the toilet tank, you know? They canned his ass in a hurry. They would have sold him offshore if he had a dropping nigga in him. Shit you not.
Billy had made his way back to the window, and he risked another glance outside.
No, man, no. They can come in any time they want to. That's why I've been so freaked out, you know?
He crossed the room in two long paces, sat down across from me, sudden and hard.
So let's go, okay? What do you want to know?
Banged his fist on the table.
What do you want to fucking know?
You said something about Murph. Who's Murph?
Fucking no one, man. Murph wasn't there. He wasn't fucking there.
Murph was one of the gate men. But Murph used to be a driver, just like Billy. Murph owed Billy all kinds of favors. Billy had gotten Murph high more times than he could count.
And laid, too, man. Laid and fucked up 100 times.
And it was Murph, last Sunday night, who was scheduled to be at the large vehicle exit point during driver clearance. The trucks and the truckers are checkpoints separately, Billy told me in his special Billy style. Trucks get searched while the cargo goes in, then they get searched again by a whole separate team before they're sealed. The loaded trailers are towed to one of the 7 LVEPs, where they are connected to a tractor. That's where the truckers show up, at the LVEP. That's where they get their driver clearance before climbing in the rig.
I'm serious,
Billy said bitterly, hissing out a long contrail of smoke.
I do not know how I got into this fucking mess.
Maybe Billy didn't know, but I had my suspicions. Ada guessed it was sex that had roped the man in, a pair of nubile abolitionist nurses. But looking at Billy, inhaling, twitching, pulsing, I figured it had to be drugs.
It all depends on who's doing that hand search, you know? And it was supposed to be Murph. I had the fucking envelope, though. I was holding it.
Billy had been directed to leave his jacket slung over his balcony. Unit 8, 3 stories up. And then, when he went to put it on that Sunday night, lo and behold, a padded envelope was in the pocket. You would never approach the LVEP with anything remotely resembling contraband, except that on this night, it was supposed to be Murph. The whole plan hinged on Murph's weak vigilance. Then Murph got the flu.
You believe that?
Old cigarette out, new one lit.
The fucking flu?
Kevin, meanwhile, in his terrible hiding place. Barrel of shit, barrel of blood, barrel strapped to the bed of a truck. The truck in lurching motion, the rattle of the wheels, the slosh of the fluid around him, the sick, close, dark air. And then, after all those miles, Billy pops him out of the truck at the truck wash. He's ready for his connecting flight. And where's Luna? Where's the package? Billy?
It was just bad luck.
Billy?
Bad, bad fucking luck.
Billy, where is it? He screwed up his eyes and stared at me.
What?
The package, Mr. Smith. Are you telling me it never went off this plantation? Are you telling me it's still here?
Yeah, it's here.
He was close to the point of tears. He gaped at me. He pressed his dirty fingers into his temples.
That's what I'm telling you. It's here.
He got up with a jerk so fast he wobbled and nearly fell down.
It's in my fucking fridge.
My ticket to freedom was exactly as it had been described. A padded envelope, 5 inches by 7 inches. A half an inch thick. On the front, the logo of GGSI, and on the back, Kevin's initials. I traced his handwriting with the tip of my forefinger. I felt nothing. I put my palm on it and waited for the rush of feeling I was expecting, the dream of my new life in Little America, maple trees and a frozen lake and the curl of chimney smoke from my small wooden home. The envelope felt like nothing. It felt like a small package, 5 by 7, with a slight bulge in the center. The crazy courage of this kid. Jackdaw, born as Kevin. The balls. Lying to those holy fools the whole fucking time. Go and get that girl and I tell you where I put your fucking envelope. When he never even had it.
He never fucking saw it. He had never held it in his hands.
All of it a wild bluff. Tricked Barton, tricked me, tricked everyone, all to get this girl Luna out. And now she was dead. And now he was dead. And here I was, in the inside of his world, mourning him all over again, this crazy, courageous kid. He's down there dead in the water. And here I am. Billy Smith was hovering behind me, twitching back and forth on his heels, hands in the air, breathing heavy.
Yeah, man, I'm just glad to get rid of that thing. I mean it. That thing's been giving me bad dreams, man. Real fucking bad dreams.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah.
His breath was hot and stale.
You know that lady? That lady that got shot? I dreamed that, man. Night before it happened, she was giving her, like, testimony, you know, in my dream, with the long table and the microphones, all those ugly men staring down at her. You know they wear those flag pins on their jackets?
I stood facing Billy, holding the envelope, feeling its small weight in my palm.
Everybody was just freaking out, you know, calling her this and that, nigga lover and everything, and then someone just came up behind her and...
He made his fingers a gun, grimaced as he fired it.
Pow! Shot her head off, you know? That was in my dream. I dreamed it. And then the next day it happened on the fucking news.
I tucked the envelope into my waistband at the small of my back. Still, I was waiting to feel something. The rush of possibility, the thrill of victory. Waiting to feel my future coming.
So, all right. So what the fuck, man?
Said Billy.
Somebody coming to get you? You got something set up?
No.
What? Were you? How you gonna get out of here?
We're going to figure it out, Billy, I said. We'll figure out something.
We?
He said. His eyes bulged in his narrow face.
Oh, no way. Oh, no. No fucking way.
We were back and forth on it for a while, Billy and me. He was trying to make me understand what I already knew, what I probably knew a lot better than he did, that it was impossible. People have tried all the ways, man, he told me. Packed in crates, sewn into seat linings, wrapped up with a palletized load of cargo, inside the engine block, clinging to the chassis. Jackdaw got out, I told him. You got Jackdaw out.
Yeah, but that got planned. You hear what I'm saying, man? That got set up for a fucking year. I mean, I was part of it. I don't even know how long that got planned. And so what do you want to do? Just like what? Fucking ride out shotgun?
No, I said. Of course not. Although that was among the options I was considering. It was on the list that was writing and rewriting itself in my mind, possibilities arranging themselves in order of plausibility. I could hold Billy hostage or appear to hold him hostage, whittle a wooden gun from one of his sofa legs, build a bomb out of refrigerator parts and strap it to his chest and let the gate men know I'd kill him. There were so many flaws in such a plan, so many questions. I thought through the map of the place, thought about the buildings that abutted the property's edge. What about that Institute for Agricultural Innovation? What about the black building behind it? It was marked off somehow. It was distinct. It occurred to me that a building so marked may be operated separately, may have its own separate system of entrances and exits. Flaws and questions, questions and flaws. I stood. A quarter of an hour passed, then half an hour. I did my own version of Billy's dance, pacing a circuit around the small space while Billy took his turn sitting, watching me think. Subway tunnels, delivery trucks, employee parking. I looked out the window. The sun was going down on the plantation, with shadow patterns on the concrete courtyard, with the bright green lawns past the fence turning darker when the real plan began to form itself in my head. Not a good plan. Not even close. But perhaps the best of all the bad. Billy, are you allowed to go into the town if you feel like it?
Of course, sure, yeah.
He eyed me warily from the table, a cigarette dangling from the corner of his mouth.
I'm not a slave, man. I just gotta sign out, say where I'm going, what time I'll be back, and then I gotta sign back in.
All right, I nodded. This was something. I sat across from Billy. You're gonna go into the town and find a payphone. And then you're gonna dial the telephone number I give you. You're gonna say exactly what I tell you to say, and the man on the other end is going to say, okay. Then just stay where you are. 10 minutes later, the Turner alarm will sound.
What? What the fuck are you talking about?
Listen. You're going to call that number, a Maryland number, my man in the system, Deus Ex Machina, and the Turner alarm will go off. They'll go to lockdown here and send out the wagons. The alarm was part of the Turner system. It was mutual defense. Every plantation in every county in the Hard Four was required to maintain a reinforced vehicle called a Turner wagon with a small armed company of guards that could be sent out to any other plantation experiencing insurrection. A threat to one being understood as a threat to all. The system is named for Nat Turner, of course, the Virginia slave who with his Confederates slaughtered 50-odd people in 1831. Although the system didn't become common until the so-called Star Man Revolt in Carolina in 1972. So you got it? I told Billy. Siren's gonna wail, wagon is gonna roll out.
And then what?
Said Billy.
Where are you gonna be?
I'm going to be on the wagon. That plan might have worked, too. There were still some pieces to figure out, obviously. One more ride on that subway, a few more choruses of These Strong Hands Belong to You, a couple more tricks to pull, but I was ready to try it. And I think Billy was, too. But then all the sounds started at once. Chopper blades, a dozen automobile engines roaring in fast, car doors slamming, boots on the stairs, Billy's nightmare made real. I shouted to him, looking back over my shoulder as I ran for the window, but Billy had fainted. He was flat out. The window was useless. The door was splintering inward. A dozen people were yelling, freeze, yelling, get down, yelling, nigger, get down. A forest of gun muzzles, me on my knees, following instructions, hands up, hands laced behind my back, head down. I had no gun. I had no knife. I only had that envelope 5x7 and padded and marked. And it was torn from me as they dragged me down the stairs. Chapter 9. I knew I was underground, but that was pretty much all I knew. I had been battered. Dragged out of free white housing, kicked with boots and hit with batons and thrown into an armored car. Pushed through a door and tossed onto an elevator. Same manufacturer, I noted dully, as the one in headquarters. Murdoch Elevators of Murdoch, Louisiana. Someone shocked me in the midsection with a taser or a stun gun. And I fell down. Now I was lying on a steel floor. There were tender spots, budding bruises on my arms and legs. The metal I was on was cold. I was naked. My hands were shackled to each other, my feet were shackled to each other, and a loop of chain was drawn between the two sets of shackles and then through a metal loop bolted to the floor. I passed in and out of consciousness one or two times. Who did I think I was? I was just going to waltz out of there, ride out shotgun like the man said. Who did I think I was? For a while, I kept thinking there was someone else in the room with me. A dark figure huddled in the corner. Is that you? I even said one time, whispering reverential, but nobody answered. And when I managed to move my head around, there was no one. I was alone. When I woke again, though, I could hear someone breathing, shallow breaths, and a light tapping, tap, tap, tap. You up? I shifted my weight, and the chains rattled. The man who spoke, whoever he was on the far side of the room, still making that soft noise, tap, tap, tap. I turned my head, fought back a rolling spasm of pain, and saw him. He was inside my cage with me, leaning against the thick steel door with his arms crossed, bored. In one hand, he held my envelope, Kevin's envelope, 5x7 with a small bulge in the middle. He was holding it in his right hand and tapping it, tap, 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 against his left bicep. The man was familiar to me, but I couldn't quite place him. A wide neck, very pale skin, dull eyes.
Come on, he said. Get up.
I knew where I'd seen him. The Fountain Diner, my first meal in Indianapolis. Cook's partner, thick-necked and red-faced. Officer Morris, who wouldn't know he was on fire unless a pretty girl told him so. I guess someone had told him something. Up, he said again. Time to go. Part 3. North. Compromise is not the worst of sins, but it is the busiest. The only one we're all of us doing, 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. Reverend Kevin Shortley, On the Urgent Necessities, 1982. You are not alone. I am here with you. Though you're far away, I am here to stay. Michael Jackson, You Are Not Alone, 1994. Chapter 1. One more hotel room. Motel, maybe. I don't know. Morris drove for a while, some dull collection of dark hours, with me in the back of the unmarked silver sedan he had shoved me into by the top of my head. And then I saw a neon that said, Vacancy. I saw a squat one-story building, and then I was at a door with a number 4 on it. One more ugly hotel room, facing one more deserted parking lot in one more invisible town. Morris knocked on the door marked 4, and it was Willie Cook who answered. Cook, with his shark smile, his dancing eyes. He was out of uniform, sleeves rolled up, chewing a piece of gum and holding up his hands as if to welcome an old friend. "Well, all right," he said. "You made it."
"Oh, my God,"
said Martha behind him.
"Oh, my God."
Her voice reminded me what I must look like. Battered and bandaged and chained, Cook, without turning, said, "Now you stay where you are, baby." I watched Martha sit slowly back down on the edge of the bed. I formed my mouth into a smile. "It's fine," I thought, just as loudly as I could. "Not as bad as it looks." Morris had taken me out of the leg shackles, at least. At least I had my pants back on. I let Morris push me into the room, and I stood where he placed me, in front of the rickety little motel table between the kitchen area and the bed area. Cook settled into the table's one wooden chair and put his feet up like a working man relaxing at the end of his hard day. There was a gun on the table, too. Not his service weapon, some snub-nosed thing, and a laptop showing a screensaver of the Indy 500, colorful race cars moving in patterns on the sleeping monitor. Morris tossed Cook the envelope, and he caught it, held it a second, then set it down on the table. His big gold class ring made a hollow knock on the cheap wood. "Well, all right," he said again. "Nicely done." Morris fetched himself a beer before settling with a sigh into an overstuffed chair beside the window. He had the bottle in one hand and his service weapon in the other, pointed at Martha. She looked bad. She looked half out of her mind with weariness and confusion. There were at least no bruises on her face, no blood at the corner of her lips. Her eyes were dark and panicky, roving back and forth between Morris and Cook, Cook and me. God, that girl should have run. She should have run from me in Indianapolis, in Green Hollow, Alabama, at Garments of the Greater South. She should have run. She should have run from me a million different times. "I don't understand this," I said to Cook. "What is happening? What is she doing here?" He blew a bubble, destroyed it with his teeth. "Did you forget?"
"What?"
"Your leash, son. Father Barton's laptop, tapping into your tracker, keeping tabs." It was the same laptop on the table in front of him next to the gun. "I didn't forget," I said. "But it was my understanding that when I had the lost package in hand, I would return directly to Indianapolis and give it to Father Barton." "Yep, that was indeed the plan." Questions were struggling to the surface of my mind, one by one, then all together like animals emerging from mud. Had they known the whole time that I was planning to double-cross them? To turn this goddamn envelope over to the marshals? Was it just Officer Cook who had been on to me, or was it Barton also? And what about Morris, who Cook had told me knew nothing about his airline service? What was he doing running these kinds of errands, not to mention how? How would Morris come by the authority to get a man sprung from the bowels of a mega plantation? The only question I said aloud, though, was my first one again. What is she doing here? "She's insurance," said Cook, "to make sure we get what we need." He pivoted in his chair, pointed at Martha. "Tell him, honey."
"They've got him," she said, her voice coming like from underwater. "They've got Lionel."
I turned back to Cook. Caught him poking his tongue through his gum, stretching it into a thin pink membrane. "Why?" I said, "why?"
"Settle down, boy," said Morris, shifting his pistol from Martha to me. "You settle down."
Martha stood, hands clenched at her sides, and Morris brought the gun back to her.
"You too."
"Please," I said to Martha, trying to calm her down. Calm myself, too. Whatever was going on, I didn't think these guys were kidding.
"Please, sit."
This now for Martha on top of everything. What she had learned only hours ago about Samson. And now this? Martha sat on the edge of the bed and tilted her head back and stared at the ceiling, and the moonlight coming unevenly through the blinds washed the side of her face and made her look old and sad. "I was bringing it to you," I said to Cook. There was a fresh, dark feeling blooming in my stomach, filling me up like internal bleeding, and I heard that darkness come into my voice. "I was going to bring it to you all."
"Sure you were,"
he said. "Sure." And then new subject. "Oh, just by the way. You know, I don't think you ever told me what your man's name is. Your agent, I mean. In the marshals." "Oh, Martha," I thought. "Oh, Martha." This on top of everything. "Bridge," I said quietly. "Lewis Bridge."
"Oh, huh." Cook snapped his gum. "I was thinking. Wouldn't it be funny if I had the same guy?"
There it was. An answer. A lot of answers, actually, all arriving together. All at once. Actually, my man's a lady, Cook added. Deputy United States Marshal Shauna Lawler. I never met her, but she sounds sexy as hell on the phone, if you're into white women. He flicked his eyes toward Martha.
I don't,
she said.
I don't.
She stood up again and Morris said, sit. And she said,
what does he mean?
Me and your boyfriend here, Jim, or Victor, or what do you call him? Brother, I like that. Me and brother, we're just the same. Same little secret. He stood up solemnly from that wobbly motel table, pointed a finger at me, slow and intoned. Nigger stealer. Soul catcher. Government man. He lowered the finger, sat back down. Just like me. I waited for Martha to say something else, anything else. But she didn't. She might have said, I don't believe you. She might have said, it can't be true. But from that corner of the room, there was nothing. I didn't look at her again. I couldn't look at her anymore. Cook was done smiling, at least. All the winking and smirking, all the wise-ass men of the world business had fallen away in an instant. Without that smile, he looked like a different human being. He sat rigid in the chair and his face became tired, closed with sadness behind his eyes, like the shadowy water just visible under the surface of the sea. I wondered what I looked like now, when at last I wasn't trying, not pretending anything. I wondered what I was looking like in that small room, alone with Cook's revelation, with the truth of what I was at last filtering out into the world. Please believe me, man, I'm not happy about this, said Cook, his voice low. About none of this. But you're my chance, okay? You're my chance. He stood up again at the table, leaned forward while he talked, while he explained, while he tried to explain. All I'm supposed to do is get Barton's secrets. That's the job. Get the man's secrets, and they set me free. That's my deal. 2 years I've been at it, and 2 years he's been keeping me low on the pole. Errand boy, muscle man, bullshit. 2 years. He put up his hand and spread apart two fingers. He turned abruptly to Martha. Then here comes your friend. I did not look at her. I couldn't. Sad little mush-mouthed Jim Dirksen. Talking about his wife in the mines. Here's my chance. I push you on the priest. Let's do this one. Let me quarterback it. Tutor me, Padre, you know? Here's my chance to learn some secrets. Get into the inside. Agent Lawler keeps saying, get what we need and you're done. You're free. Every time he said that word, free, I felt sick. Lord, what they had done to this man. What they had done to me. The monsters they had made us into, prowling along, sniffing for chances. But then you, he pointed one finger at me and wagged it. You gonna turn out to be what you are? Turn out to be like me? And I was like, whoa, whoa, wait. This is even better. Morris belched long and loud. Settled in the armchair, coasting through this dull guard duty with the bored confidence of a white man lording it over a black and a woman. I stared at Cook, remembering his excitement that morning on the banks of the White River. Kevin lying dead, Maris furious, Barton grieving, Cook seizing the moment. I was having my realization in that moment, and he was having his. I explained to Barton that he should send you to go and get this thing. I told him how we could tap your chip. How I had me a solid connect in the Marshals. Then I called up Agent Lawler. Me on the phone with Bridge, sending him to BWI Airport, and Cook, or whatever this man's name was, on the phone with Lawler. Phones ringing off the hook in Gaithersburg. I said, listen, baby, remember this evidence Barton's been so hot on? What about I get that for you? Illegal collusion. Major federal law breaking. Well, she liked that a lot. She loved it. There was no point in explaining to Cook that his agent wanted her hands on the evidence for the same reason mine did, to get rid of it. And better than that, I said to her, I said, what if I can get you one of me, a nigga catch a soul stealer motherfucker like me? Except this one's gone to the dark side. He's working freelance for the airlines. What if I get you all that? If I get you all that, you gotta let me go, right? Then you gotta set me free. He lifted the envelope off the table and I was surprised at the sudden pain I felt. I felt it in his hands like it was a part of my body, like it was my heart he was holding. The idea of that thing going back to Maryland, getting buried by the Marshals after all Kevin had gone through to get it, all that Luna had gone through. Even me. But that's where it was always headed anyway, wasn't it? I was never really going to bring it to Father Barton so he could announce it to the world. But somehow, in the wake of Cook's revelations, I was mourning that alternative future, longing for a victory I'd never really contemplated.
So what's up, man?
Said Cook.
We're going to take out this hard drive, hook it into the laptop here.
He gestured to the computer on the table.
Just to make sure you didn't pull a fast one, like my pops used to like to say. Make sure we got what we think we got, and then I'll call Agent Lawler.
He tore the envelope open at the top. I held up my hands, the chains rattling.
Wait, though. What if Barton's right? I said. What if there really is information on there that could...
What were the words, all those hopeful, lunatic words?
Shake the foundations, change the world, just what if?
Come on now, he said.
Barton's full of shit.
Yeah, I know. I know. I took a step toward Cook, aware of Morris in the corner of my eye.
But we're talking about the future. The future of the country. Talking about 3 million slaves.
Cook said something familiar. Something I had thought to myself, and not long ago either.
I ain't thinking about the 3 million, is what he said. I'm thinking about me. Wait. Hey, hey.
He had the package open. He pulled out what was inside. He looked up at me.
What the fuck?
Motion from the other side of the room, Morris rising from the chair.
What is that?
We were all staring at what was in Cook's palm. Then suddenly Martha was moving. She was off the bed just as Morris was off the chair, quick as choreography. She grabbed Morris's beer bottle and smashed it on the edge of the table, making a weapon that caught Morris in his rush. So it was really his own running that drove the broken edges into his belly. He screamed while Martha turned the bottle deeper, and I lurched my body forward, overturning the table into Cook, knocking him against the wall and banging his head hard into it, sending a small burst of plaster out onto the both of us.
God damn it!
He said and reached for his gun where it had skittered on the tabletop. But I put my hands on top of his hands on top of the weapon, and we were struggling for it when over my shoulder I heard Martha shouting,
Shit! Asshole!
I jerked up hard, bringing all four of our hands up off the table. Cook clutching the pistol and me clutching his fingers, both of us yelling. Morris was holding his wounded guts with one hand, but the other hand held his automatic and he was trying to get a bead on Martha, who had just rolled behind the bed. I wrenched Cook's finger and the shot was an explosion in the small room. Morris fell but got off one shot at me as he was falling. I did not feel the bullet. Didn't feel it because it had caught not me, but Cook, and a geyser of blood erupted from the center of his throat and his eyes went wide and white, wide like Castle's eyes. His eyes in the darkness, pleading eyes, wide in the rain. Castle wanted to go back and help Reedy, and I said no, we couldn't go back, and I was scared too, but there would be no more chances, not like this one. Reedy was dying and the rain was pounding and that fence post was loose. I had seen it come loose and this was the only opportunity we were going to get, the only one we would ever get. I told Castle what he told me so many times he told me, that we were different, that there was more for us. But he said not if we died, not if we got caught running and they put us down or sold us offshore. And he was scared, I understood that, goddammit, I was scared too. But standing out there in the rain arguing made no sense, we had to go, we had to fucking go. I grabbed him by the neck and told him we were going, and he said no again, fighting and pushing back at me. And I squeezed his throat and his eyes went wide and wider till he stopped fighting, and then I ran. I ran away alone. Rain washed the blood from me while I was running, and everything I've gotten since I have deserved.
He's dead,
Martha was saying, yelling.
Victor, brother, he's dead. It's too late.
Cook was under me. We were on the ground. I had my hands on his neck, trying to hold back the blood, push it back in. I was trying to heal the man, but his eyes were open, staring, white. Very slowly, I let him go. There was blood all over me, blood on my hands and up my arms and on my naked chest. I stood up. The room was full of red.
Okay,
Martha was saying. She was trembling. I was trembling, too.
Okay, okay, okay.
Chapter 2. The steps of the monument were gray and slick with rain. I stood beneath the martyr with my hands in my pockets. I didn't smoke. I didn't tilt my head up to feel the drizzle on my cheeks. I didn't move. I stood beneath old Abraham, quietly fiddling with the green bracelet I was still wearing on my arm, doing nothing but waiting. The streets were empty, more or less. Laughing voices now and then carried over from Georgia Street, the blocks of bars a quarter mile or so away. I saw a couple leaning into each other, climbing unsteadily into the back of a cab way down on Market Street. But the ring of shops and office buildings that wreathed Monument Circle were all closed this late at night. Here in the bullseye of the city at this hour of night, it was just me out here, just me in the likeness of Lincoln. both of us likenesses. And just what was Victor feeling anyway, as he stood there waiting? What about old Victor? What was going on inside his mind? I don't know. I was drained of emotion, washed out by the rain. I suppose there's a version of this story in which I'm standing there crackling with joy. Maybe I should have been crying, tears carving rivulets in my stone cheeks. Monumental. There might even have been, in some other reality, knives of regret scything away at my insides. But none of that. Not for me. Just standing, just waiting, coat shrugged close around me, my hands jammed in the pockets of my coat. In one pocket was the gun, a loose heaviness in the pocket's depth. In the other pocket, my right hand was clasped on one corner of the envelope, folding and unfolding one ragged corner. Up in the sky was the dim, grubby outline of the moon. Abraham Lincoln's giant, disapproving features in shadow above me, staring at the city, the country, all this unfinished business. Victor. Yeah, come on up. There was Mr. Bridge, coming carefully up the steps, one step at a time, not wanting to slip. And despite myself, I felt the tiniest prickle of disappointment. There must have been some part of me hoping for a surprise. What if Deputy United States Marshal Bridge had turned out to have about him the smoldering air of a secret agent? What if he'd been 6'6" and thin as a rail, wearing loyal Texan cowboy boots and a battered Stetson? What if he wore a yarmulke? What if he were black? Alas, Bridge was Bridge. A bushy gray mustache and a sloping forehead below a receding hairline. Tan slacks and brown dress shoes, poorly chosen for rainy late autumn Indiana. He stood before me and my Abraham, a supplicant before the prince and counselor. He was the puffy, dull-eyed middle manager of my most contemptuous imaginings. This, my tormentor. I raised my hand as I came closer, and he raised his in return. Bridge's tie was brown and plain. I fidgeted with the envelope's dog-eared corner while Bridge came up the steps. Bridge was alone, per my instructions. I could see down Meridian Street the car from which he'd climbed. He'd emerged from the driver's seat, and I couldn't tell if there was someone in the back or not, but it didn't matter. Here at the steps, it was just me and him. Bridge approaching, no bag or case, his hands raised as instructed. I had thought through all the details, got the setup straight. A public place, but a public place wreathed in darkness. A dead downtown in the middle of the night. It was 1 o'clock in the morning, Sunday morning. 2 days since Martha and I returned to the north. Almost 2 weeks since Kevin was stuffed into the barrel, rolled onto the truck. 11 days since I checked into the Capital City Crossroads Hotel, just down the hall from Martha and her son. I ducked my hand into my other pocket and Bridge stopped abruptly and raised his hands higher. I smiled. A glimmer of feeling reached me, distant but clear. It felt good to be in charge, even of one man, one small moment, one instant. I wasn't reaching for my gun, it was the envelope I took out. Mr. Bridge's eyes flooded with relief. He was easy to read, easier than ever, now that not even a phone line separated us. He was just here, 10 feet in front of me, his features as open and plain as a child's drawing. He reached out, as though I was just going to hand it over, and I could see it all in his face, the pressure that had been applied on him from wherever it had come. I dropped the envelope back in my pocket, and he darted out his tongue quickly, licked his lips. "That's it." "Yes." He nodded, licked his lips again. "I must hand it to you, Victor. That was well done. I don't know how you did it, but that was well done." "I'm a professional." "Yes." He nodded, "yes." "Well, I hope you will not be surprised to hear that I am prepared to live up to my end of the bargain as well. If you would just..." He took one more step up the stairs, and now my other hand came up, the gun hand. He stopped. "What is it?" I said. "What's in there?" He stopped. "Have you opened it?" "Bridge. Question with a question." I went back on him. "What do you fucking think?" His eyes above the gray mustache were growing fretful. He didn't like my tone. "Of course I opened it." It was still open, as a matter of fact, and it was in my pocket with the open end up. I took it out and held it up in the dim, rain-flecked moonlight. A small flask of sturdy plastic or polystyrene full of clear liquid, secured with a screwed-on cap. Still floating in there after all this time.